7 o'clock, so let's begin. I'll begin by welcoming you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern. And Tuesday evenings is an ongoing lecture series. So we started 2 weeks ago, and we'll go through mid-April. So I invite you to get on the website and check out the schedule, see which ones you absolutely cannot miss, and then come to a few of them that you're not sure about because they're sure to please. The lectures, of course, are free, but we ask you to pick up a ticket at the info desk in case anybody got past us without a ticket. It just helps us keep count, so we appreciate that. I also want to take this opportunity to announce that on Sunday at 1, we're doing these Sunday with the Modern tours, and they're artists, architects, scholars of all sorts, writers, art historians, and such, that come in and they talk about either the permanent collection, the architecture, or the special exhibition from their particular perspective. And of course, we choose them for their interesting perspective on the topic. This Sunday, the British artist Richard Patterson will be here, and he's going to talk about the exhibition of Ed Ruscha's work, Ed Ruscha Road Tested. And I have to just tell you that Richard has two ends into the exhibition. He's actually been in a show that was kind of about Ed Ruscha. He can explain more, and he's had conversations with the artist in that regard. And then he also is a car buff, so he's always entertaining, and he should be very interesting with Ed Ruscha being his topic. So I invite you to come back 1 o'clock on Sunday. We'll meet at the top of the stairs. If you come for another tour, it may not be at the top of the stairs. So always ask at the information desk and tell you where the 1 o'clock tour on Sunday is meeting. So with that out of the way, next week, our Tuesday evening speaker is artist Sterling Allen. He's the co-founder of OK Mountain, which is an art collective in Austin. He's a very good artist. He also has a show, exhibition opening titled Housing Edition. It's opening at the Fort Worth Contemporary, which is on TCU campus. And that opening follows his Tuesday lecture. It's on Friday, March 4th from 7 to 9. So it's kind of nice. We get a preview, get to talk to Sterling a little bit, hear about his ideas, and then go see that exhibition that following Friday. Tonight, we are fortunate to have architect Brent Brown with us. Brent is an AIA LEED, which stands for, and I had to look it up, and I was really happy to find what it stands for, and most of you in this audience know, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, accredited architect. He works in Dallas. His mission is to bring design thinking to all communities. Brent earned his Bachelor of Environmental Design and his Master's of Architecture from Texas A&M. He later attended the Harvard University's Affordable Housing Program, which, according to his bio, is where he discovered an interest in delivering more thoughtful and affordable solutions in architecture. And presumably, this training contributed to his phenomenal efforts with community-based work and ultimately his founding of BC Workshop, and that stands for Building Community Workshop. Where he is the founding director. AIA Dallas has recognized Brent's work through BC Workshop with a 2007, 2008, and 2010 Awards in Excellence in Community Design and Sustainable Design, and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, in conjunction with the American Institute for Architects, awarded Brent's Congo Street Green Initiative the 2010 National AIA HUD Secretary Award of Community-Informed Design. Not surprisingly, Brent's approach has led to numerous collaborations and individual projects in Dallas as well as nationally, and I hope that Brent will have the opportunity to present some of those programs or those projects in tonight's lecture. In 2009, Brent was named the founding director of Dallas City Design Studio, which is an office in the city of Dallas in partnership with the Trinity Trust Foundation that raises the design consciousness of Dallas while balancing social, economic, and environmental aspects of sustainability towards enhancing livability to all Dallas residents. Brent also represented the Southwest region as part of the President's Forum on Clean Energy and Public Health at the White House this past November. I recently came across Brent's work, met him at a luncheon, really just in passing, but hearing him talk about the ideas he presented at the luncheon and then hearing a little bit about his work from him and from others, I was really blown away by his effort. His efforts and was extremely encouraged to know that he is part of the DFW community. So as is often the case, I decided Tuesday evenings was a great place to learn more about Brent and his work. So with that confession, I would like to turn it over to Brent as he presents Design Justice, which is written in all caps. Please join me with a warm welcome for Brent Brown.
So thank you, Terry, for that wonderful introduction and for having me here tonight. And let's see if this... Bingo. Wow. Design in action. I am an architect. I am not from Dallas. I'm from a small town in East Texas. Kilgore is where I went to high school. Our family farm is between Troop and Henderson in a little place called Henry's Chapel. I'm a sixth generation Texan, and I'm an Aggie. I could have chosen a lot of ways to maybe begin to approach this. Fort Worth's a place that I've come all my life. My father, who wears cowboy boots, M.L. Letty and Son, is where we would have an annual trip to get a pair of boots and stockyards, and it's a wonderful experience. But unfortunately, I've never lived in Fort Worth. And so from a context, I'm going to refrain from talking about Fort Worth tonight. I'm going to stay where I know a few things, which is Dallas, and use that as a context for both in my work directly as well as the topic or title of this discussion. Our metroplex, our DFW community, which is probably the right way to phrase it, it's huge. I mean, you know, I haven't been able to really unfold the entire, you know, census data yet, right? It's all out there now. But we're, you know, 7 million people and over 10,000 square miles. It's giant. And community is one of those sort of wonderful words that we use to describe scale, both from that 10,000 square mile to down to probably a block. And in all of those scales of place, design plays a role. And so somebody might say, what do you mean by design justice? Community engagement, maybe I can understand that, but design justice. The premise is that cities are designed. The places we live and work and play, they are designed. Now, justice is something we're probably pretty clear on, right? We're familiar with social justice, environmental justice, economic justice. So what about design justice? Well, architecture and planning that both go to either create structures for city development or structures in cities are political acts. They're the gathering together of people. They represent values. the question is everyone's values represented? Historically, at least in Dallas and in other parts of the world that I'm familiar, the equity of those values are not always present, meaning that the political structure is sort of who gets to be at the table and who can be at the table. And it's not always an issue of wealth. It can be the wealth of time and not just the monetary side of things. And so as an architect and as someone who, 15 years experience, and 10 years ago I left what was a great job working for a very talented architect, Gary Cunningham in Dallas, someone who I admire greatly and who had great influence on me. And when I started my own practice, I decided that, I wanted the opportunity or commissions, to practice within some of the great types of projects I'd been working on with Corky, like houses and institutions. But I wanted to try, in my own way, to forward an ethic, which I believed was at the basis for having a profession such as architecture. And that is to practice in such a way where whether my own person or hopefully through peers would recognize the relevance of my work. And that meant to go outside of just designing houses. It meant to be involved in the issues of place so that the design work that I engaged in could have a sort of bearing on the issues of the day. So design to me is a very broad sort of practice. I don't exclude engineers. It's obviously inclusive of artists. And architects lie kind of in the middle a little bit between those two. But the employment of sort of creativity, creative thinking, ideation, as a way to embrace the place you live. And through that, and this is what I hope to illustrate, is that there can be justice in place. So, Dallas. You're going to see this image several times, but from the air, cities always kind of do end up looking like the same thing as an amoebic little cell under a microscope, right? These crazy little tentacles flying all over the place and sort of trying to grow and figure out a way to deal with its edges, or in some cases, like here in Texas, the lack of an edge and just the continuation of sprawl. These are necessities within cities, infrastructure. But how and where they get placed. And I like this image so much because as I come back and talk about some of my work in West Dallas, this to me has become kind of a poster symbol of how and where things get chosen to be. And oftentimes we think they have to be there. Well, now they do because they are. But when they were placed, they might have been placed because there was no resistance to that location versus the will to want it there. You encounter places in every city like Congo Street, which I'll spend some time on in a minute. But they're places that, in this case, really went forgotten. They were just kind of, nobody paid much attention to them because they just thought they would go away. Right? I mean, is that something that can echo a little bit here? I mean, they're just parts of our city we just don't pay any attention to. But if a city is by design, then is the removal of parts of it from our consciousness actually also a part of that design? So I got to kind of do a giant disclaimer here, because whenever I get introduced, people say, "How are you the founding director and director of BC Workshop, which is a private nonprofit organization? And then how are you the director of an office in the city of Dallas at the same time? Do you work for the city? Yes. Are you an employee of the city? No." It was a bold move, and I'll touch on this again as I get to that part, but it was a bold move to say that we could try an experiment in Dallas where we could put design in the core of City Hall. We could have it be made up of city staff. We could have an advisor from somewhere else. But at the same time, we could have a director that's not an employee. It's sort of one leg in, one leg out. that could be an architect or a designer. And so I'll touch on this, but in the core of everything that I'm going to talk about is the same sort of ethic that goes to equity in place, a city by design, and the practice of engagement to those trying to make change as well as those affected by change. So very quickly, in the ideation process that many of you are very familiar with, you can go through the very traditional ways of observation, interaction, you know, ideation, interaction, iteration, and et cetera. The piece here for us that's most important is this interaction and interaction. So notice, before ideation, it's actually having that interaction with those making change or affected by change. And I'll say that several times. The other piece of this is that once you've had some great brainstorming idea, you're able to turn around and hold yourself accountable back into that sort of network where change may occur. And so, you know, we take that very seriously, and while creativity is a tool within it, restraint is probably the most important skill that we use. It's the ability to not work until you're able or can work because of a familiarity, or at least attempting to become familiar. So seed is a term which was by a Loeb Fellowship group, Loeb Fellow alumni, which was coined to try to reposition the discussion around sustainability. Everyone may be familiar with the USGBC's LEAD program, which was defined earlier, which I don't even know that I could do that again in what it means. This one I do. Seed was trying to say that, look, we can be, the environment's important, and the way that we consider the economics of building important, but the social aspect, the equity within place is of equal value. And the design, so social, economic, environmental design. And design is very critical to how we begin to balance those. Or to be quite blunt, sustainability is about achieving balance, but what we know is that we're probably going to have to be out of balance in order to ultimately get to balance, because we've been out of whack, we could say, for quite some time. So now I'm going to touch on some workshop stuff, and then to keep it straight and clear, then I'll go to begin to talk about the work at the City Design Studio with the City of Dallas. So gatherings like this are frequent, where residents, and in this case, I wanted to make special note that I was fortunate to teach for three springs at the University of Texas at Arlington School of Architecture. And these are students from a fourth-year studio that would be engaged in a dialogue. They would ultimately design a house, which I'll show you in a minute, and then we would build the house. But these kinds of conversations, and it's on the terms of, we could say, a client, but it's really a partner in a lot of ways, which in this case were residents that were living there on Congo Street. So Congo Street, as an initiative, had this kind of crazy breakthrough as a result of conversations, is that when you have an existing street, and in this case, it is one block long, it's 20 feet wide, and it is tired. The gift of architects and artists is when you see a place, and really see a place, you look beyond those physical qualities often, and you actually can uncover whether it be from any of those aspects of sustainability, you can begin to see a structure or a framework that others don't see. And in Congo, what's amazing is what you had was a perfect model for a small cottage-type development that, to be honest, if it hadn't been in South Dallas and it was in North Dallas, it would probably be seen as a small gated community. But despite its tired state, there were families that owned their own homes. And there was actually a master plan for this area that had received a level of support from the city financially that basically just showed this gone. Now, the residents that lived on this street really didn't know about this plan. And when they were shown the plan, they said, well, we're not going anywhere. Why would we want to go anywhere? And most people, when you might visit and you would say, but why do you want to live here? Because these houses are falling down. You know, wouldn't you want to move? Well, if I ask you that about where you live, what would be your perspective? I think many of us would say, well, wait a minute, this is my home. I was born here. My mother died here. I don't want to move. So through that design, as an intervention, came up with this crazy, wacky idea that we could build a house, and then through a leapfrogging effect, without displacement, individuals, we could work on their home. They could move into the holding house. They named it the holding house. We called it transition house, right? It's an architect. You know, they called it holding house because it held them. And they could move into the holding house. And this is such a simple idea, and I've talked about this so many times, but I will tell you, some of the smartest people I've ever talked to just couldn't get it because it was so simple. It's just really, really dumb. So there's a vacant lot. There's existing houses. You build a house, right? Small footprint, 698 square feet. It's lead gold for $50,000. It's modest, simple, right? Family moves in the house, you work on their house. They're on the street, they don't have to leave. Their social fabric doesn't get out of whack. Because what you learn is that in small communities, especially modest or really poor communities, they rely on each other. Those that are still there, that are fighting it out, not willing to leave because they hold on to it as home, they rely on one another greatly. And so you sit, you meet, you talk, you come up with great ideas. These are some of the other students from UTA here, Jorge, Caco. You know, residents are sitting around and talking and looking, and you put up all your ideas, and then, you know, they say, well, you know, that ideation process, right? That's great and wonderful, but now that we're having dialogue again, we need to talk to you about this because that really doesn't work. We think that design needs some change. And you keep going. And so you build a simple little house. It's little Kanye sitting there on the front porch. And I described it already. And that's the act that then earned enough trust to then, Frankie Bolden, who lives on that street, and the story that I told you just briefly about someone's mother who died who was born on this street is Frankie Bolden. She has a master's degree in education. She's a DISD teacher. She lives on Congress Street. Frankie was the first person to let us work on her home. Her home was splitting apart, and we did our best to sort of rethink it, but we ended up having to tear it down. Now, let me ask you a question. If I knocked on your door, and I said, I tell you what, I'm going to fix up your house, but I want you to move out into this house, and then I'm going to tear it down, and then you can move back in. How many of you would be willing to do that? And you've only known me for like 4 months. Trust. Frankie's house, with the reuse, all of the materials from her house were either recycled or used within the home. Lead platinum, $50,000 again. It's a goal to try to look at it from an economic standpoint by which we could actually begin to deliver affordable housing that was highly energy efficient, et cetera, right? But not have to look at the different types of subsidy models. Now, the thing about Congo Street, that the underlying fundamental work that we did and still are doing is that if we started a house, we'd finish a house. That was it. No promise to build six, no promise to do anything, as I'll talk about in a minute. It was just, we start a house, we finish a house. It was that simple. And so Frankie's house, as Frankie and Erica enjoy today, Pat and Ernest's house came next, and then a couple of more shots. It's very simple. It's very modest. 720 square feet, two bedroom, one bath, and a study. Miss Ella. I'm going to spend a little bit of time. Miss Ella, you don't want to talk about a great client. You don't want to talk about somebody that will hold your feet to the fire and hold you accountable. It's Miss Ella. Just that smile will tell you pretty much everything you need to know about her. 4533, when we started this project, it was pretty interesting. Miss Ella just stood up and said, I'm going last. Now, by the way, remember I said one house at a time. She didn't think we'd ever get there. So Miss Ella's was the sixth house that we worked on in Congo. And talking about a pretty prideful day when we were getting ready to get started, and Miss Ella said, "You know, I've been thinking about this, and by the way, here's my floor plan." And so here's someone who had never drawn a floor plan before in her life. I want to touch on something real quick. Frankie, when Frankie's house was being built, there's an ordinance in the city that when you build a house, you have to put a sidewalk in front of it if it doesn't have one. Congo's never had a sidewalk before, right? But you have to. It's the ordinance. It's the law. Now, there is a way you can get out of it. If you're the resident, you can request your way out of it. To have Frankie fill that out and to go to the city and say, "I don't want that," was an empowering time for Frankie because she chose the context that she lived. She now is influencing its physical appearance, and she's saying no to something that someone else has told her she's got to have. Because they didn't want one. They didn't have enough space because the porch is 4 feet from the curb. Put a sidewalk in there, and there's no front little garden space for Frankie to be able to plant. So Miss Ella's house, which I think we kind of by that time could get a little bit bolder. And by the way, I will tell you, if Miss Ella thought her house was going to look like this before we started, she probably would have sent us home. But I think Miss Ella would tell you today she loves her house and she wouldn't trade it for anything. So Congo Street, and you can see it here, this is what I was talking about. It's 19 feet back of curb to back of curb. And you know, I see some folks in the audience that had worked on a project that fought like hell just to get a 25-foot wide street. And I see Catherine nodding now. And this is a 19-foot wide street, really. And we didn't have to fight to be able to illustrate that a small street can work. The same with these houses. They range, again, originally they were about 625 square feet. The largest one we built is about 980 square feet. And we've even, it's pretty amazing now, some investors have moved in. These were all vacant, with the exception of Miss Sarah, have moved in, are redoing those as rental housing. Which you say, wait a minute, they own, do they really want rental housing? Actually, they ask for rental housing. The homeowners that are there says, not everybody can afford to own their own home. Rental's okay. Now, depends on, you know, we don't want loud music, we don't want a lot of partying, come on. But rental's not the issue, it's people. So I wanted to show you a couple other things. We entered the phase where we've been working on trying to deliver power generation on site. So what you're actually going to see, and this is, you see Frankie's home, this is Vanessa's home, solar panels. This is a 5.4 kilowatt array that just got installed last week. Omar's been working on that really hard. This is a solar thermal for water heating on Pat and Ernest. Frankie's home with and Miss Ella's, both with PV panels, the holding house, and Mr. Bowie. Now, what I left out here, which is also pretty important, is that the lot that we built it on was owned by Mr. Fred Bowie. And I never forget, I said, "Mr. Bowie, we got this crazy idea. What we've heard is this, people don't want to go anywhere, and we think we can build a house and then come up with this model where people can migrate, you know, move in the house, move out. And you own that lot, so can we buy it from you?" And he said, "You know, I've heard a lot of stories and a lot of ideas. You know, I think there was some guy that was going to build a big football stadium here that was going to make all our worries go away. That didn't happen." He said, "But to be honest, this is the best idea I've ever heard, and I'll give you the lot." I mean, he didn't have to do that. But it's taking control and power of your place. So I love this image because it talks about the street. This is Congo. What you'll see here is the street itself as it exists today. This is the south side, the north side. This is missing Miss Ella's when it was finished. This was actually from a workshop just 2.5 weeks ago, where we have either end of the street has been redone. Curb and gutter, sidewalk, asphalt pavement. Congo was forgotten. Remember when I said that? It was intentionally left out. It didn't get any new surface or drainage-related sort of expenditure, right? You know, capital improvement. So what we did was, by planning that holding house and then doing this other work, the city goes, "Okay, it's not going anywhere. So we're going to redo the street." And then we said, whoa. "Why don't you let the residents that live there have some impact on this street?" And so it will be technically really the first green street in Dallas because it will have pervious pavement in the right-of-way. Funded by the city. So now the city's opening that door to think differently about integrated stormwater management. But this, there's a budget for landscaping. So TBGU is a volunteer landscape architecture firm that partnered with us and helped to create some indigenous plant recommendations for the area. And we used a very creative tool of acetate and photocopy and plotting. And we pinned them up on the wall and said, what do you want in front of your house? And that's what they came up with. And you know what? That's what's going to go in. So I remind you back again of a little small street and a little bitty house, which, you know, I think is when a lot of things really came together for the workshop, was when we built that house. We had been recognized before for a small project, but we weren't even an entity yet when we built that house. It was just an idea. And now we've grown, and there are 11, soon to be 14 people in the workshop working. And I will tell you, if Miss Ellen knew how many people had seen her face, you know, and how much the message of where residents in a community that don't want, they want change, but they don't want to leave, have had an impact. It's pretty powerful. So now I want to tell a separate little story, and this kind of goes to a way of working. Most people look at these and they say, number one, what the hell are they? Is this some scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark? And but they're actually empty storage pods, these plywood boxes that you know, you rent, and they bring them and you put stuff in them and they take them away, right? Well, what we got a call one day. It's like, hey, we got 150 of these. You want them? Why in the world would we want them? Well, Andy Sturm had a pretty cool idea, who works, I'm fortunate to work with, and with some folks kind of began to re-envision them. You can see them back there in the corner. Well, they're made of really great materials. Plywood, other things. So we actually extrapolated them into a tool for community engagement and some work in a neighborhood called Dolphin Heights. So what you see here looks like a blank canvas in a lot of ways. What follows, though, is in most communities, people actually, you know, how many people in here know how to read plans? Okay, how many people in here don't know how to read plans? If we walk outside this room, the majority is don't know how to read plans, right? Because they never look at them. No, we look at maps to kind of get around. But in general, oftentimes people and the boundaries of their neighborhood are kind of loosely defined. They're based on either sort of relationship or experiences, but they're not formalized in a lot of ways, in a lot of areas of our city. So in this case, for a neighborhood that actually declared itself Dolphin Heights and actually had begun a neighborhood association, and this was their boundary, to then be able to use a tool like a map, right? Really simple, to then sit across from individuals and talk about the community. And the way you do that is not inside a pretty room. It's on a vacant lot in the neighborhood at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday with free coffee. And you just sit there and people come by and they talk. It's on the neighborhood's turf. Now they're kind of like, what in the world are you doing? But it's a way to say hello and get to know folks. What comes out of that are relationships and other work in a place that lead to fun kind of hilarious antics that then kids, as a result of getting to know things, begin to declare, please don't throw trash on our playground. Because for them, this was a playground. If you're thinking about spaces from a designer standpoint, we might say this isn't much of a playground. But if you know if it keeps going, it runs to White Rock Creek. And then at White Rock Creek, a trail system is planned. It becomes some spot within a larger context of connectivity. And it goes to hope. So now I'm going to talk about a project we're working on right now and share some of the aspects of the community engagement or interface that we do. The cottage is a little project that it's 50 units. And we were asked to take a look at the Housing First model, which is directly going to those without a home. It's the idea that one can find stability through housing. And this is going at a project that's an amalgamation and partnership between the county and the healthcare system of the county, the justice system. And it's actually a model looking at, with private foundations and private nonprofit or nonprofits. It's looking at the cost of the homeless to our city and saying, all right, how much does it cost within the criminal justice and healthcare system? And what does it cost for a house? And what are the statistics that show that based upon housing, the reduction in cost in the criminal justice system and in the healthcare system? And it's amazing. And we're talking about a 20+-to-1 relationship, especially when you think about the life cycle of this. So in order to do that, you sit and you talk and you try to get to understand. So these are individuals and these are conversations with individuals that are formerly homeless that have now found a way into some form of SRO or other type of more permanent housing situation. And here's the site. Well, before we design on the site, it's right near downtown. And before we design on the site, though, we have to have these kinds of conversations. And yes, just like many others, there are parlor tricks and other kinds of shenanigans that you can play to get folks to begin to talk in a different way. And what so often we learn from this is just looking at the relationship in the discussion and as things are being changed. And what can result, you know, from simple things like this are the knowledge about public and private space and how that may be influenced based upon experiences from, a segment of our community that most of us don't know anything about. And as an architect, I'm not going to profess that I do. So the experts here are those who have dealt with those issues. So even to the site and what that might mean. Now, this prepared by Elizabeth in the workshop begins to look at the accountability that we want to place through diagrams and other forms of infographics. So as we capture information, we begin to interpret it. We begin to think about it. What does this mean with regard to the relationships, you know, close to, far from? And this is a way by which we can hold ourselves accountable as the final product gets designed. So in coming up with that, how do we think still about sustainability and energy and the idea of rainwater collection and all those kinds of things that you have to do? And by the way, that's just stuff we have to do. We don't see it as add-ons. It's a part of practice. Just like when I speak, social equity and community engagement is a part of practice. And if you don't want us to do it, then go hire somebody else. Thinking about a place with regard of scale and individual, and these are just some diagrams I thought you might find interesting, as we're trying to begin to understand and actually draw from really kind of historical development patterns, the idea of small villages or clusters, you know, very early settlement patterns to think about the relationships. But at the same time, how many people know that, or you all know, I should say, that as development occurs, typically those that are most central to the ring or the first, oftentimes more wealthy, those on the outer ring end up being sort of the late arrivers, right? And they couldn't afford to move up to the first ring, right? So in here you're trying to even employ, and if you actually begin to, if you look into here, it's like everyone has a shared space, but there is no front door onto the common, but everyone has a view of the common. And sort of looking for equity within the exactness of the design so that it's not so as to say someone is not more important than another, it's just to say that the structure of it doesn't make it an obvious outcome. So some images, just some simple character images. There was, you know, and again, all of this, that we had to go to this point after we'd been through some work, but we had to do this because the client wanted to do fundraising. So they need some imagery. But what we've said count and time again, don't get too close to these things because they're probably going to change. And they are. They're changing a lot. So what that means is that this is on the site, actually, where we moved in a container and we've got a little exhibit. And, you know, we've actually, Beck is going to be the contractor. So we're out there periodically having, and we need to do many more of these, having these kinds of gatherings where it's in a place where homeless exist. So one of the challenges we put back to the client was to say, what services are you bringing to the site prior to the development of this project that begin to go at solving a homeless issue? Because you're talking about clinical services and how this stability through a house, but by the way, what are you doing to help connect people to that opportunity? Because if you don't, you're just like every other developer out there that's just going to buy a piece of property, displace whatever's there, and then put what you want down. And so now it's a question of how does that begin to happen? So we're playing as a sort of a knife-edged sword a little bit back and forth. You know, and this, one of the things that was really fun, this is Andy at the end, we call this the Andy Jesus photo. And no disrespect. But with this and sort of pinning, this is Congresswoman Johnson's entire Washington, D.C. staff and Dallas staff that wanted to learn about how we were trying to engage communities. And so they spent a morning with us and traveled around and looked at some things. And we could directly talk about this as a means to engage in the serious conversation about our city and place. So I've mentioned, and this is just a sort of an illustration of a few of the folks that I get to work with at the workshop. And this is, our office is a really messy place. Kelly, who is right here, is actually right there. And I'm glad she came tonight. She hears this all the time, so I must be Fort Worth was why, and the modern is my guess, probably. But very collaborative. This is actually a brainstorming session internally. And, you know, I'm the guy talking tonight, but in all of the work that I've been fortunate to be engaged in, it's always been in collaboration with others. And I don't know who owns the idea. It's just a question of whether it's good or not. So I want to go to this one, 5750 Dallas, because when you begin to get engaged in an issue like homelessness, and so we were working on this cottages project, and we needed to do a service project on Martin Luther King Day. It was kind of this sort of idea that it's a day of service, what are we going to do? And a lot of people could say we're in service all the time, so we didn't want to just, you know, go and, I don't know, paint a house, which I won't get into, but we said, how could we be an advocate today on that day? And really try to go at what Dr. King's message was at its core, and then also try to raise awareness locally and maybe some level of discussion. And so 5750dallas.org was literally it's like a four-day project leading up to Martin Luther King Day, where the troops in the early morning, there's Kelly again, began to go out and deposit this kind of an idea. And so it was at the point of, and by the way, these were at traffic intersections. These were on public right-of-way throughout the city. They were in 12 locations, and so it was an army of 36, and to see what would happen. And so began to have this sort of idea of, you know, here's where we can drive you to get more information. This is a quote from Dr. King. You know, there's no deficit in human resources. The deficit is in human will. Whew, that'll get you. It's a friend of mine that says it a little differently. It's like everybody knows where the problem is. The question is, what are you going to do about it? And then here, beginning, it was right before the Super Bowl, right? You can tell by the overcast nature of this. This is just literally a month ago. You know, so you think about a Super Bowl ticket in 4 hours, what will it buy you? It could give you a homeless person a bed for 2 years. Yeah, it's a little jab, but still. Can I tell you what's really funny about this? Is that they were treated with respect. We actually put one on SMU's campus because we thought it'd be the first to go. It actually didn't get touched. It's the only one that didn't get picked up, which was kind of like a reframe in our mind. That was like, because we thought, you know, whew, there was going to come the university. It was like a block from the university police station, too. So this is another Elizabeth infographic where we kind of said, what could our impact be? So if you really look at it, it was kind of like, how many visits came to the website, you know, to our website. It wasn't about us. It wasn't raising money for us. It was a way to try to advocate for others. So we were doing it, but you weren't supposed to give us money, and no one did. What was the project budget? $48.50. And then what was the impact? It actually got picked up, and I'm picking on Kelly since she's here. Her mother calls her from Ohio. Kelly, you guys are on TV. What? CNN picked it up. So really simple little things where you can see not a lot of effort can make a big difference sometimes. Now, one of the downfalls of this was that part of the discussion turned to code enforcement, and like we hadn't gotten a sign permit for this, and one of the local writers, Jim Schutz, picked up on it and said, give me a break. Are you really going to talk about sign ordinances on this? Did anybody miss the point? Or did you get the point right? And just, you know, okay, fine, we know that. Which, by the way, they were all picked back up, and they weren't littered on the street, so there was no defamation of space or anything like that. So, back to the city, right? Our playground. Let me talk about this, because anytime you see an image with flags on it, you know it's got to be official. And then when you see the mayor, and then when you see the city manager, and then you see a local philanthropist, and the chair, Mary McDermott Cook, she's the chairperson of the Trinity Trust, Gail Thomas, who in a lot of ways, you know, I've learned so much from Gail, and I think a lot of my work is an extension of her work. She's been advocating in our city for a place that is soulful and mindful of all of its, all of not only the individuals, but its origins for over 3 decades. Mary Soom, who's our city manager. And then you got like, who's this guy? You know, he's like, what's an architect doing in that picture for darn sure, right? And David Whitley, who is a planner at the city who has become a staff member in the studio. An individual, Dee Dee Rose and Rusty Rose's family, they gave a gift to the trust to set up the studio. And a part of that gift, $2 million for 5 years to help establish and get it going. And it began with the idea that, and I'll tell a little story here in just a minute, with the idea that it could begin with a public-private partnership and over time would become entirely a public endeavor. And it would sort of phase out that funding over time. Well, I got a call from Gail 2 weeks before Christmas, 2008. And she's like, Brent, I think I need you to come to a meeting. Well, when Gail calls you to come to a meeting, you pretty much know you got something you're going to have to do. And didn't really know a lot about it. So I show up in this meeting with Gail and Mary Soom. And we have great conversation. And Dee Dee comes in. And they're trying to figure out how to affect the Trinity River. You know, now we have a river too. Oh, it's the same one, right? Except ours is after a couple of them come together, which is a little bit different. And the idea, you know, we've got big plans for our river. Different, because we have a different kind of river. We have a rural form of flood control. You have some levees here, right? But you also have topography in some certain parts of your city, which help. But this levee, and this is the way we feel about our levees a lot of times, you know, don't go near there. You're not supposed to be here. But turning the river into a place for people. But as it comes through our city, and as we invest billions of dollars in changing it, what about the communities along its edges, right? How do we begin to think about this side of the levee, not just what's inside? And so the studio was born out, I believe, of a lot of the practice that I was undergoing at the workshop, but in the precedent that I had used, which is around a community design center. This is something that's an outgrowth of the civil rights movement. They were happening in a lot of cities on the East and West Coast, a lot of times with universities. So it was when at Columbia University, architects came off the hill and went to Harlem to work. A great quote that was delivered to the AIA National Convention in 1964. It was the 100th anniversary of the AIA Convention. And I'm just blank on the gentleman's name. He was the head of the Urban League at the time and a civil rights leader. And he, I'll think of it here in a minute, he said, due to your thunderous silence, architects are irrelevant. Because our cities have been planned. And when we look at the decay and we look at the ghettos of our urban cities, you know, what have you been doing about it? I'll never forget when I read this speech, I was like, holy cow. And this was in 1964, and okay, what's changed? So back to studio. So how do we think about those communities outside our levees, along it as it changes? And how are we deliberate about it? And how do we employ design in the core of that action? And so our river here, we're building this wonderful new bridge designed by Santiago Calatrava. So the first place we would work is at the end of that bridge. $120 million investment. It's a bridge that goes to a 5-lane street. To the north of that street, it's a 300-parcel Mexican-American community, which in the first meeting, and by the way, remember my BC workshop hat over here? Pretty cool in communities. Go into the city hall? Not so cool. Walk into a room of over 250 people, and a guy in the back goes, we didn't ask for that bridge. Okay. I don't think we can do much about that. It's coming. The question is, how do we go forward? And how do we go forward in a way that everyone is included at the table? And so I was fortunate and have been fortunate to been able to work now with Larry Beasley from Vancouver. If you saw the Olympics a year ago, you saw his work over the last 35 years of building one of the most livable places in the world. He consults all over the world, and he serves as a special advisor of urban design to the city of Dallas. And so Larry, there he is right here. This is Vancouver. I mean, it is gorgeous. If you haven't been, I suggest if you can, go. And he brings that over 40 years of neighborhood planning experience, which he often gets associated with towers and density, but at his basis, he was working in neighborhoods in Vancouver when he started right out of school. So he understands that strong connection very well. So at the end of that new bridge, which is right there, see, okay, here's the Woodall Rogers Freeway. There it comes across. Now, do you see any freeways? No. You see an old bridge that will become a pedestrian bridge. So you're going to have a dedicated bridge across the Trinity that's going to land right beside a Calatrava design bridge. It's going to change sort of movement patterns from a vehicular standpoint significantly. And then here is an area about 475 acres, and I'll get into this more here in just a minute. So I'm going to run through this. So there's the focus area. What you began to see is that there's businesses. This is a big postal center. But there's businesses that are here and here. There's a lot of void. And then a wonderful, modest neighborhood to the north. Now, in this area right in here, a group of investors has bought about 60 acres of land. They want to make change. They want to build a city of the future. Well, of course, we all want to build a city of the future. And we want developers to be profitable in that regard. But how will we build it? And how do we put in a structure or a framework in place that can be successful over decades? And so that's what I'll touch on here. So the way that we work, not unlike my work that has been at BC, is that you bring people together and you bring multiple interests together in this case, because you're talking about large geography. You bring multiple interests together and you listen and you have each other listen. Because remember, when I talk about if architecture and planning is a political act and cities are by design, if we can pool together those interests, no matter how desperate they are, then design can maybe be a way through. And so you sit at the table, and this is I love this photo, Gary Cunningham, who volunteered his time, Butch McGregor, one of the investors, Sophia from the neighborhood, planning commissioner, Arturo Del Castillo, who works in the studio, Keith Manoy, transportation planner, that's Graham Green right there, and then this right here, is on the community service side of the city. City employees, residents, developers or investors, designers sitting around the table, and what are they doing? They're drawing. And then we all stand up and we talk about it, and we go through these iterations, and we have these kinds of crazy looking drawings, and then the studio sits down, we worked all night long, we synthesized them, we came back out the next morning, we had everybody back in, everybody thought it was a really good solution. And it basically, in its fundamental way, it has yielded a document, and I'll talk about the concepts briefly, but what it did was it put together for the first time a new way of doing something in Dallas. This isn't about zoning. This is about some form of structure and guidelines forward. It's not called a master plan. What happens when you draw a master plan? Everybody holds it up, this is what's going to happen, and the next day somebody comes out with a new plan. Right? So how do you create a structure where flexibility and change can happen, but yet it holds on to a set of core intentions or principles, right? Not unlike what I hope I have in my own practice. And so in this area, the structure gets laid out, and there's a series of seven principles which basically consider those interests for those who want to make change and for those who are affected by change. And by the way, the neighborhood, before this started, we don't want any density. What does every neighborhood, single family, say that we know? Typically, we don't want density. Density's bad. That's like apartments. You know what apartments brings, right? Especially if you're a poor, modest neighborhood, it's like you're going to build stuff, million-dollar condos, all that stuff, right? So it may not be as much about the concern for crime. It may be about the fact that they're going to be displaced. Now, the residents, Eva, who lives right there, she showed up at the Plan Commission hearing where this was unanimously voted to recommend approval, and she said, "We want density. We just don't want it right there. And we want you to be careful about how you are adjacent to us. But you know what? Right here, go. Now be careful. Not too high. 30 stories? That's not too high. That's So at its core, what we said was when we looked at the area, and this is the role, this is what designed it. This is what is a process and is a product. Because this is the product. It said the rail line had segregated this area into two halves for almost a century. We had two crossing points here and here. And what we can do is punch three new holes. We can concentrate the density here. And by the way, the Union Pacific rail line that does here goes through Arlington, Texas and comes to Fort Worth. It's the best commuter route we have to connect to the billion-dollar stadium. Is it a commuter route right now? No. DART has it on its 2030 plan. Most people don't think you can do it because the freight traffic is so high. It's one of the number one freight lines in the country, and everybody goes, oh, you'll never make that happen. Really? You're going to put three holes through the middle of it and start having some buildings up in there, and I guarantee you we'll turn it into a transit stop. Union Pacific will respond when they have to. So with community input, with those businesses' inputs, this was unfolded. So number one, preserve, conserve, enhance La Bajada neighborhood in its entirety. And the guys that have bought this land right in here, 68 acres, that most think probably originally wanted to displace that neighborhood, have said, we support that. So I'm going to run through some of the contents of this, but it is slated for a city council public hearing. My clock's not showing up, so what time are we at, real quick? Okay, I need to wrap up then. And I'll go through this quick, because this gets boring. But what this gets at is a new way of thinking about the area over time, and as development cases come, as development comes forward, and as proposals for zoning come forward, that you begin to weigh that against the tune, as you would say, if you're a musician, or the spirit of what this structure is about. And if it's in keeping, and it promotes, or it comes up with something really new that's actually upholds and begins to promote these kinds of principles, then it ought to move fast. The city ought to find a way to support it, the city ought to get the zoning in place, and that should be the least encumbrance to the project. Now, if it doesn't support it, as right, you can bring forward your case just like you could anywhere, right? By law. So it doesn't threaten personal property rights, but what it does is it encourages what becomes a structure and guidelines for an area. So we have to think about neighborhood character. I'm going to go through these really quickly. We begin to talk about the creation of new communities as well as the respective old communities through neighborhood boundaries. We talk about street infrastructure because the public right-of-way is 20% of our public space, right? And if we're not thinking consciously about the street, then what are we left with? And we all know what those streets look like. Public space in general and a very intentional way of green space and the other. So, by the way, as development happens in this area, let's don't build it out and then go, oops, we don't have a park now. Because, by the way, at that point, you can't afford to do one. So how do we at least put in place the notion that we have to have that? Architectural guidelines. Wait a minute. Are you trying to tell me what color building I can build? No. We're trying to say when you engage public space and public realm, you need to support it, just like you want that street to support your development. So you need to be thinking about things such as building access and, you know, the facades and transparency and the siding of the building and other elements like that, heights and things in relationship to the street so it doesn't just become a canyon and et cetera. A good designer, because we are, I believe, as an architect, we're probably the most regulated profession on the planet. I mean, doorknobs are regulated. Seriously, guys, levers, handles, ADA, they're regulated. We don't shy away from regulation when the spirit of it is intended towards good design. Now, we don't want us, you know, to say it has to be this way or it has to be that way, but we work well within it, and we can manipulate it, and we can find our way through it. And that is the role of design thinking, creative thinking, and art in many ways. So we have to draw cartoons of what it may look like, how it may unfold, right? Ultimately, what we're looking at here is 24,000 new residents over 30 million square feet. We're talking about $3 billion worth of development with a small neighborhood up here that's protected and enhanced. Now, the first thing a lot of people will say is, but wait a minute, all that development happens, people are going to want to buy their homes. Is that a bad thing? Do you want to not be able to sell your home? Anybody. It's the opportunity choice that can be presented. Now, the question is, does change happen in such a speed that individuals cannot prepare for that? We've done some studies on the tax increment base that will go over a 10-year period of time, potentially. And in essence, by talking about this edge and how we need to protect this neighborhood, where is speculation going to happen? It's going to happen down here. We've talked about enhancing and protecting an existing neighborhood. Anybody in their right mind from an investor standpoint is not going to go up here and buy a 5,000 square foot piece of property and know they can't rezone it for anything else because they can't. It's going to be R5 zoning. So what are you going to build there? A modest little house and sell for $50,000, $60,000, $70,000? So speculation will be forced here as a result of sort of that even playing field. Now, the other question is, are you ghettoizing the neighborhood? So no investment occurs there. No, because intentionally, in the roadmap, it talks about working with affordable housing builders, targeting 100 vacant lots. How do you begin to create new housing there that's in keeping with the neighborhood? So it's balanced in its approach. So there's a proportionality to investment that happens within the area so that while you can put cut-throughs and you can help to encourage all kinds of dense developments, how are you also helping to encourage the stability of that neighborhood and the change in that neighborhood? And this is a city. All those drawings were done in the studio. And it's unleashing, right now we've got two RFQs on the street for gateway design and other things such as that, that are making work for the local design community in Dallas. Picture of our city. Miss Sarah, a resident in that city. And in our work, while we engage places, we must always think of everyone, despite economic situation. And so if you turn this on its head a little bit, design justice, hopefully you at least kind of say, okay, I get kind of what he's talking about. But community engagement, I want to put a spin on it. Because community engagement up to this point, I have talked about the way of working. Now, flip it and think about the idea of artists and architects engaging their community. And that's what I think I chose to do with how I work, was to not be on the sidelines and to actually go and directly try to work in the place in an intentional way to solve problems other than just built form. And that, to me, is the future of professions like architecture, is to find its relevance in issues outside of just buildings. So with that, I thank you for your time. And I'm sorry I went a little long. Normally I talk about one of these things. I don't talk about both of them. And it's kind of a first time to do that together. So yeah, I'm happy to take questions and hang out also if afterwards. So questions, thoughts, complaints? Anybody that didn't ask for the bridge either?
Yes. The city said the process to fast-track the program through the coding and the process?
Not fully, although the agreement, we work with every department. So we're just, you could call us a department, but we're not a department, we're an office. We work with all of the other departments. And zoning specifically, we work a lot with the city attorney's office as a result. And actually, to have a city attorney, found out real fast, one of the city attorneys actually rides transit and walks to work. I was like, okay, now he's going to get it, right? Because he's choosing that, and he does. John does. We have idea of how to do that. We are trying not to get ahead of ourselves because council has not yet adopted this. So we will be unfolding an implementation process that follows. So think about this as a three-prong approach, but in phases. So the first was really design. And right now we're in the political process. And what I don't know that I said clearly is that we've employed design as a potential solution to a political problem. Because historically, especially in zoning cases, we could take this room and put an aisle down the middle, and you're for it, and you're against it, you're going to speak, and then we're all going to look at each other and go, okay, either you're going to be mad, or you're going to be mad, or we do nothing. But in this case, the interests at the table have declared support for this. And if the council adopts it, we will then roll up our sleeves and have an implementation process to think out of the box. Now, the document says expedition. Now, how you do that, whether it's staff, a staff person, the studio supports that, that's one way we can do it. But at the end of the day, we will solve all those problems during implementation. Yes, ma'am?
Well, then do you see it as a prototype for development like this throughout the city?
I think process. And this, you know, nobody likes to hear about process. People go to sleep when you talk about process. Yes. the idea of convening and having a dialogue and trying to, you know, let me tell you, we've had meetings, and this is city staff, having meetings in living rooms. You know, there's a work in a particular area where somebody's really affected and they invite their friends and it's in a living room. We were doing community meetings for a year before the official public process began. So when the public process began, a lot of people were just kind of like, okay, can we get on with it? Rather than normally, when the public is engaged in work in the public arena, it's when the political process starts. You know, there's a lot of work and design that happens, and then you have this public hearing or public engagement, and then all of a sudden you realize, ooh, they're for and they're against, so let's figure out how to solve this now. Well, the water's been poisoned at that point. And it's very hard to come. You have to almost let things sort of settle for a while and hopefully mend fences. So yeah, the process, I believe so. We're right now looking at where we'll work next. And, you know, I think something that's really important is that as we work with all of the departments in the city, this work, while the studio is kind of the hub for it, every other department has had a hand in shaping it. The documents were edited by all the departments and reviewed by all the departments. And I think it's actually owned by the organization and not just the studio.
Yes. Is there a way to track what's happening with this? Is this available online? And actually, we're Dallas residents, so I'd be very curious to see how this unfolds.
We have, the studio has a website inside the DallasCityHall.com. I think it's City Design Studio after that. It's off the main page. You can click to it. One of the things, that, when you look at the action program forward, it's about existing community. It's about creation of new communities. It's about an incremental nature of landholders and businesses. Because one of the components I left out is that how do you seek to find equivalencies within the code to help activate existing buildings that are vacant? Because to be blunt, if it's an existing building and you have to spend too much money on it to put in something that's only going to be there for 5 to 10 years, right, you're not going to do it. Now, life safety cannot be compromised, but there are examples of equivalencies being used all over the world where you will allow people to do things to meet the spirit of the code, but in a different way. And as an architect, I will tell you, I have done buildings where I have talked to the officials and proposed an alternative solution, and they've accepted it because it was in their interpretation right and it was in the spirit. But that's not published anywhere, so unless you know how to do that, you don't get to do it. And they don't like to publish it typically because then that means everybody will do it. So somewhere between mass chaos and a policeman is where we're trying to work. And so those equivalencies are important because, you know, there are a lot of existing businesses in West Dallas, a lot of jobs that are still there that are, I would say, are manufacturing. I had a guy ask me a question. He has a gas storage facility. They sell the welder supply type stuff. And he said, hey, when all this change comes, nobody's going to really like me being here. I said, well, that may be the case, but it may just be you have to change your sort of operations a little bit, because I don't see anything different than, you know, what you're doing and, you know, a lot of other adjacencies. It's just how you are a neighbor. You know, how are you neighborly or not in a lot of ways. And so we have to find a way, and I think through that incremental sort of, I'm not going to say organic, incremental way of change, we may be able in this part of our world to become more comfortable with those differences in community or in how we build. Because inherently, we like everything to look the same and we want it all to be even the same use and everything else, right? And I think West Dallas offers a really unique opportunity for us.
Would you say that the process for West Dallas was the first time that's been tried on that scale in the city of Dallas?
No. No, comp plan, in a lot of ways, which is above this, is higher scale. I don't think anything we're doing is anything new. I think that when I say that, it's not like it's ever been done before. I think the question is, if we have the way we've positioned design, typically design happens, right? And then you go about this public process or involved process. But in most cases, the role of design is not as positioned I think is centrally focused in the process. So we had the thing called the Dallas Plan that died, like just about every plan that happens, because plans are supposed to die. Because if unless you just think you're a genius and you can, you're like you're Nostradamus or something, you know, and you can predict the future. Plans are for moments in time. That's why we, I mean, calling it an urban structure and guidelines, that's never happened before in Dallas.
Yes, sir. How about all your planning, zoning, building permit fees? Does Dallas waive those?
Not right now, because they, you know, in general, no city has any money. So waiving of fees. So, and I'm sorry, I was trying to close pretty quick. But well, let me tell you, an implementation of anything, but especially around an area of a city like this and this size. Implementation, I talked about existing community. So how do you directly go at the issues and concerns of that place, right? So if housing is going to be built there, how is it in keeping in the spirit of what that neighborhood wants, right? You just don't want anything to be built. As you bring about new development and density, what you recognize is that just like you need the investment in that existing community, you're going to need investment in kickstarting a level of new development or new community. And that has a typical kind of supply-demand graph where the first one is going to need to have the greatest amount of incentive, and the last one should be probably giving something back because it's so easy. It's like a walk in the park. So part of implementation will be to, I mean, the expedition of a project through zoning is probably the easiest one, just due process. And that's manpower and, you know, about it. Coming up with the incentive structures and those other mechanisms that are necessary, the chambers, Oak Cliff Chamber and West Dallas Chamber, both unanimously support this and have brought forward a business case for this plan. And I think over the next 6 months, assuming it's adopted, over the 6 months that follow, we will have a series of implementation charrettes in a lot of ways that will unfold a lot more mechanisms that can make the intentions a reality. So to your point, that may be in it. It may not be.
Well, for instance, on the street that you redid, the permit, who's paying for that?
Workshop.
Okay.
Yeah, no, there's no ways. No, there's nothing being waived there. So in the work that we do, it's like within the structure, we're working like anybody else. Do you have a question? No. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I am curious, what, as a designer in architecture, what drives you to just sit back as a normal designer in architecture to really, in society, to really, like what factor?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Thanks. You know, we're influenced by a lot of people, and my parents are one. You know, I mean, they had a direct influence. My parents had a small business, and you know, watching them do things that they didn't need to do before people do it now, showed me that your job wasn't just how it might be defined. So if I pick up the architectural handbook for, you know, professional practice, nowhere in it does it talk about an ethic to place that directly goes to equity and sustainability, for that matter. So my parents, mostly just as a result of what I saw growing up, when I was a very young child, I saw poverty at a level that I'll never forget. My dad worked for a pipeline company, and when I was really little, and then they started a small business. And going up to a house with my dad because there was a hand, somebody that was helping on something, and you know, seeing kids in a little house with no bathroom, and it just kind of stuck with me as a kid because I went home and we had a bathroom. Well, why don't they have a bathroom? So, just things like that. Beyond that, if I wanted to make money, I'd go be a lawyer, I guess. I used to say banker, because then you get to play golf. But now that, you know, that's a whole nother deal. So, lawyer probably, yeah. Yeah.
What are the kind of features for Congress Street?
Well, it's kind of, you know, we started off with the idea we were going to build a house, and then now I think we're up to phase three. And we don't really know yet. We've been asked to, You know, we think that it's now taking on a life of its own. And one of the things that, you know, and let me tell you, Congo is not something that can be replicated easily. And a lot of people will come up and go, where's the next Congo Street? I'm like, there's not, I mean, I hope there's not one in a way, right? There's a lot of the story. We're actually trying to figure out a way to capture some of it a little bit better now. But the reason why I can't answer your question, because I don't know. But what I want to tell you is this is in the spirit of it, is that when we were, I'll never forget, I went to a meeting asking for the money to build a holding house, which was $42,500. And I was at the meeting, and they said, well, when are you going to get started? And I said, well, we're already started. They said, wait a minute, you've already started? I said, yeah, they're pouring piers today. And they said, well, wait a minute, what if you don't get this grant? And I said, what do you mean if we don't get the grant? We're going to get the grant, right? And they said, no, really, what happens if we don't give you this grant? What's going to happen? I said, well, we'll go find somebody else. And so that's been the spirit of this project. And this goes back to the previous question. When I was teaching, I had a young woman who now is at Georgia Tech getting her master's and is pursuing a career, I think, around community-based work. And she said, you know, Congo looks so hard. You know, can't we go do something else? And I said, well, let me ask you a question. How do you not do Congo? How do you not work there? And I think that goes to your question sort of previously. You know, it's like for me is I get bored picking out paint colors and you know, I have nothing wrong with that. But I just, how do you not do it? And that's kind of in what's the next phase? Whatever Miss Ella tells me to do. So. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
So how did you find the Congo project to begin with?
Oh, boy, that's an interesting story. I had been down the street. I used to, when I first came to Dallas, on Sundays, I had like this old Jeep. And I used to, on Sundays, because I was single. By the way, one of the things that made this highly possible was that when I started my office, I was not married and I didn't own a house. I didn't have kids and any, you know, I hadn't been married. So I could eat, you know, whatever for dinner and not come home or didn't nobody cared. It's a bad thing, actually. But I'm fortunate now to have a wonderful wife and a little boy that's two. And I used to drive around on Sundays and Saturdays, just in the middle, you know, I'd get up in the morning, you just drive around. And if it was a street that I had never seen, I would go down it. And that's good and bad. When you're, you know, I work in communities. A lot of people kind of go, well, how do you work in a community that's predominantly African American, and you're from a small town? I'm from the country in a lot of ways. I don't understand cities. I just knew that when I moved to Dallas, I didn't want to live. I didn't want to be in the city, or I'll go home and live in the country. I didn't want to be in between. And a lot of times, I'll say this because I take comfort in it. Actually, a lot of times when I'm in a neighborhood working, I make fun of myself. I mean, I'm the poster child. I'm a tall white guy with short hair and I wear a belt buckle. I mean, 50 years ago, I'm the bad guy. And so, yeah, you asked me a good question about where's the next Congo and then how I found Congo. It was just, it's like bumper cars. Just, I ran into it, it ran into me. The funniest part, Frankie tells this story, is that one day we were doing some community meetings in the area, and that's where I met Frankie. But I'd been down it before, and I'd been wanting to go over and talk to somebody. But it's a small street, so you go down that street, everybody knows it. You know, again, look here, knock on the door. Mm-mm. Number one, it's just not. I mean, it's not my right to do that. So I asked Frankie one day. I was like, Frankie, you know, I know Congo. I've seen those houses, and they're just these small little gems. And she goes, Jim, well, you haven't seen those houses. They're falling down. And I said, yeah, but you got to remember, I'm an architect. I like these kinds of things. I said, can I come in and see your house? And she thought, who is this white guy that wants to come over to my house? And so we walked a few blocks, and we went into Frankie's house. And it was so funny. She had laundry everywhere, and she was embarrassed. And we sat down, and we talked. She told me some stories. And she'll say, she kind of shortens it, like it makes it sound like everything unfolded in 24 hours. She'll say, yeah, and you know, and then he said, you know, I got an idea. I tell you what, let me check some stuff out and then I'll come back and let's see. And then she says, like, we built her house, right? Which was like a year and a half later. But I don't know how we find these. I think they find you.
It says, did your workshop already exist?
No. Well, I created, I was, yeah, let me tell you, and this is something that I want to say as an encouragement to young people here, is that I was trying to create the workshop for a year. I was going around, I had this, okay, it's a model. I mean, it's like almost like I was being too square about it. In that, I had like a document that thick that cited examples from all over the country about community design centers and da-da-da, and Dallas doesn't have one, and why we need one, and blah, 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 blah. And I'd go talk to people about it, and I'd say, hey, come on, let's do this. And they'd be like, that's a great idea. Well, what's the reality of life? Everybody's doing something. It's a great idea. Why don't you go do it? So eventually, I got somebody to give some money that set up a donor advice fund. I figured out this way that you could create an entity without creating an entity and not have to be rich. And you can create what's called a donor advice fund in a community's foundation. So Dallas Foundation, there's an account. And you have to start it with $25,000. And I got somebody to give $25,000, or a couple people, to put money in there to create it so we could write checks. So we could call ourselves something. And it existed for 3 years like that. And Congo Street started. And we'd already won a design award for another little project. And then we created the entity. And we created the entity because we had to be able to buy a piece of property. And then we couldn't get some certain funding because the pass-through funding is pretty limited. Yes, ma'am.
Who is the architect, Cradle?
William McDonough.
Okay. I heard him speaking, and he works with a scientist, is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
And it kind of speaks to what you're saying about, you know, how you don't even know, it's just who you are. You was meant to do this project.
Yeah. Maybe.
His response when people said, well, how can we do what you're doing? He said, you can't. You're not me. So you have to know yourself well enough to know what your contribution is going to be. Where do you come in on this? We're not going to do what you do.
Right.
We've got to figure out who we are in the picture.
Well, I think that's accurate. That, you know, I think we're all unique, and so we all find our path, and we all have gifts. Now, that said, I believe the practice of architecture can be very different.
I think he does too, don't you?
I do. I know some people that work with him, and they do wonderful work, and he's a great thinker, and I think so. The problem is that we're allowing practice to be defined by either legal or corporate means and not on sort of how to be effective and relevant. Or relevant. I would just say relevant. Because I argue that most of the architecture professions are relevant because it basically is a facilitation process. In that sense, it's just, you know, you want to build a project, you need a set of drawings and help you get the permit kind of thing. Because you can't get a permit without, let's say, certain things, over a certain square footage. And from a frequency, you know, I mean, there's Brian Bell, who's a good friend, who's done great work. 98% of buildings an architect's not involved in. So 2%? Is that relevant? And it can go also to a cultural value. We have a public defender. We have issues of public health, right? Where, you know, medicine went through this. And, you know, the idea of public health as a part of the medical profession was discounted for a long time, right? But can we think about it any differently now? Healthy communities could be thought about in lots of ways, but the physical form of it, when I was at the White House and I'm sitting in a room with people and I'm the only architect in the room, and I only got asked because the EPA kind of likes our work in Region 6 and they kind of got me in there somehow. And I'm sitting there and they're talking about neighborhoods and healthy neighborhoods and all this stuff, and I scratched my head and I said, "Who shapes neighborhoods the most? Is it planners? Is it architects? I mean, is it the city?" Because if you don't have the design community at the table, this is going to directly help to shape that physical space and changing practice there, or at least engaging it in the practice around healthy community. Is anything going to change? And the NEA is, you know, we don't have a public architect. We have a public defender. But there's no public architect. So, you know, who are you going to call when you get in jail? That's pretty easy, right? But if you want to solve a spatial issue or a physical issue in a place around, quality of life, are you going to call an architect? Newspaper's probably calling a developer. But I think to your point that I can say this because there's some young people here, is that what I hope, if anything, is that if you have an idea and it's about how you want to work, right? And I'm not talking about like an idea just to go do something, like I want to go make that. But there's something behind it, and it's like sort of this, it's within you and as an ethic of how you want to work, you know, you should pursue it. And I think to do that is, I know when I would go to lectures and you'd be like, oh, I want to do that. And I think to your point, it's not about replication, but it's about intention. And there's nothing wrong with not doing this. There's nothing wrong with being a traditional architect and service. I mean, by the way, I've had a client, and you know, I designed a lead gold home that was 8,000 square feet and two people live in. That's not very sustainable, by the way, and it's damn sure not equitable. There's nothing wrong with that. But for your own person, as you choose to do things. And what I've learned more of even of late, now having a son, is that time is all I've got. And how I spend it is what will either make me happy or not make me happy. So I tell you what, I'm going to be happy to stick around, but we can close. I don't know, do you need to make another announcement? Or come see us. Anytime at the city, we're on level 2. I'm not there, but halftime. I didn't say that, and so I literally am split down the middle in a lot of ways, although Kelly kind of says, I never see you anyway, because in the workshop, you're never there. You're always out somewhere. But come see us. We'd welcome you. And actually, you know, if there's organizations here that we could make connection with, it's not for us to do the work. It's that if we could help incubate anything in Fort Worth. We've been asked to come to Brownsville and do some work. And we're University of Texas at Brownsville is there, and we're hoping maybe we can help incubate a design center of sorts there, because there's amazing challenges in work. But, you know, any way we can be of help, we feel that's part of our mission. So thank you. And I'll hang out if anybody else has other questions, please.